Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome to the goddamn show here, man. It's already Friday again. Doesn't it seem like it's always Friday? I mean, pretty often. It's pretty often Friday around here. Seems like to me.
How can you shoot women? Children!
Easy! You just don't need them so much! Ain't war hell?
All right. Good times. I'm stalling for time here, man. I'm clicking send on things. I got Ray McGovern coming on the show. He's going to tell you what really happened in Iraq War II. Never mind a bunch of slogans and talking points and crap. We're going to get to the truth of all of that, and then so you'll be immune from all the slogans and talking points and crap. Also, Asa Winstanley is going to be on the show. He unfortunately had to cancel yesterday for important matters came up, but that's all right because he's going to be on today, and he's the guy what wrote this here article. Check it out. It's called, Why is the Media Ignoring Israel's Alliance with Al-Qaeda? And, you know, for that matter, America's. Very good stuff here. Asa Winstanley, he's from the Electronic Intifada. All right. And then also Trevor Tim. Ooh, don't let me forget. Hey, chat room guys. Well, never mind. I gotta, don't let me forget. Just like yesterday, man, I'm gonna start with a 10-minute interview at the quarter hour break here. Trevor Tim is gonna be on and talk with us about the Patriot Act and the America Free Dumb Act. Yeah, how do you know that it's about enslaving you? Cause they called it freedom. Yeah. They're going for the real subtle kind of brainwashing play there, you see. Like with the Patriot Act. The real reason Nixon created the DEA. I think maybe it was just a welfare for guns? A gun company? Is that it? I don't know. We'll see. It was some kind of corrupt cronyism, I'm sure. But anyway, Trevor Tim on the Patriot and the Freedom Acts. I think that Rand Paul might have killed the Patriot Act. Well, I mean the Section 215 part that was sunsetting. I think he might could have did it. And I was wondering, why the not a filibuster to actually stop the vote on the Patriot Act? Why this? I guess because he understands Robert's Rules of Order better than me. You know, Eric Garris tried to explain it to me, too, and I says to him, huh? I don't get it. Anyway, it had something to do with, he put him off until the 3-day weekend. He actually gave him 10 minutes, but I guess he knew at that point they didn't have their act together before midnight to get it passed. They needed 60 votes to get by a presumed separate other filibuster. I don't understand, man. I got lost. They needed 60 votes to pass USA Freedom, and they needed 60 votes to reauthorize Patriot, and they didn't have 60 votes for either. The Democrats supported the one, the Republicans supported the other, and the neither supported either the enough to get the damn things passed. And now they still have until the end of Sunday night, right? Today's the only the 29th. 30 days has September, April, November. So we got 31 days, right? Yeah, we do. We got 31 days. So they got until Sunday night to pass this thing. But I think that's not happening. I think it looks like Rand Paul killed a major part of the Patriot Act. Now, that's not going to convince me to look the other way about all the things about him that I hate. But maybe that makes me not hate him personally quite as bad. I mean, it's not like anybody else was going to do it, right? Like, God, he's horrible on so much stuff. And, you know, Mike Rogers and Bobby Jindal and Lindsey Graham and the entire... Listen, there's like 20 guys running for president in the Republican Party. And all of them are like, Rand Paul's gay. Like, that's their entire thing. Rand Paul, why, he's a sissy, panty-waist Democrat. He's not man enough to be a real macho man Republican like me, Lindsey Graham. And, you know, and Mike Rogers, who, of course, is guilty of providing material support for terrorists himself. Anyway, all of these guys, they just see and think about their minds, right? You gotta believe, you don't have to believe, you gotta understand the echo chamber these Republicans in. They really think they're right. You know, if Rudy Giuliani got up there and gave a 2007 or 2008, or 2000, was it the 2004 convention where he gave the speech where he said 9/11 700 times or whatever? If he did that right now, all the rest of these candidates would think, yeah, right, yeah, that's exactly, hey, they're way behind the times, man. They're way isolated. They don't understand how much people hate them. I mean, look at the way that Barack Obama won re-election. It wasn't because people liked Barack Obama. Everybody who did like him was disappointed in him by then. It was just that, nope, still hate Republicans more. Still not over hating you more yet. And they just don't get that. And Rand Paul could just have a ball for a year and a half, right? If he would just be just like his dad, only without stuttering. And no offense to Ron, because, man, I worship Ron Paul. But I just mean, you know, Rand, he's just a little bit better spoken, except he's never saying the right thing, or he's only saying the right thing half the time. But boy, you know, when he's stalling for time, giving an 11-hour speech about the Patriot Act, he comes up with all this stuff about James Madison and about natural rights and how the Ninth Amendment makes it clear that just because there's a list of restrictions against the government, that doesn't mean this is the list of your entire rights and all that. When was the last time anybody talked like that in the floor of the Senate? And you know he was raised as Ron Paul's son. You know he knows this stuff. Natural rights theory, the Ninth Amendment. The floor of the U.S. Senate? Anyway, they're all going after him, and it just seems to me, why pander on anything? Just drives me crazy. And especially because the other 20 of them, and they're all a bunch of idiots, right? I mean, Lindsey Graham is the guy who probably knows the issues best out of all of them. Right? Marco Rubio just a few weeks ago was confusing Iran and the Islamic State. And literally, and I don't mean was lying, I mean he thought that they were friends. And John Kerry said, no, Marco Rubio, Iran is fighting against the Islamic State in Iraq right now. Do you understand that? And Marco Rubio went, huh? That's who he's up against. All he has to do is know the truth. He doesn't have to have any kind of fancy talking point to memorize, right? He's not Jeb Bush, has to memorize a way around the last Iraq war or something like that. All he has to do is know the truth and then answer truthfully about it when the question comes up. And you notice he's been doing good on Libya and Syria because he's completely got them. He opposed both Libya and Syria. The Republican hawks supported it, and look what a complete and total disaster it's led to. And they're going to try to say, oh, it's because we didn't outright invade and put ground troops on the ground and trade up a new army and hold purple-fingered elections and support the moderates against all comers. How easy an argument is that to mock? Yeah, right. You know, all Rand Paul has to do is turn to the Republican debate audience and say, how many of you guys wanted to put 100,000 troops on the ground in Libya and in Syria? How many of you were ready to give your sons to do another Iraq War II, only in Libya and Syria? Oh, but if only we had done that instead of the half-ass war that we did, then it wouldn't have led to the consequences that now they say they need your sons again. You ready to give your son to Lindsey Graham's best judgment to go back to Iraq? Because of the war he supported in Iraq, Libya, and Syria led to the current crisis. He could have them all defeated in the space of one debate. And what are they going to say? They got nothing except a bunch of stupid crap and slogans and lies. All he has to do is be good. I'm sorry for talking about Rand Paul. I bet you guys are starting to hate my guts. I'm just obsessed with the possibilities here, you know? The possibilities. In some other dimension, maybe? This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back. Oh, I need my earphones on. I got Trevor Tim on the line. He is the, at the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He is the co-founder and the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Greenwald, Ellsberg, Snowden, and others sit on the board there with him. And he writes for The Guardian. Did I already say that? Can you tell the difference between Bush and Obama on the Patriot Act? Is the last one. But, man, he writes all really great essays there. At theguardian.co.uk, or I guess it's just theguardian.com now. Okay, fine. Welcome back to the show, Trevor. How are you?
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Very happy to have you here. Is it really right that Rand Paul successfully did a pseudo-filibuster kind of thing and killed Section 215 of the Patriot Act? Or it's not over yet?
It's not over yet. We will know finally on Sunday what's going to happen. I mean, the act officially expires on Monday, June 1st, and so that means that the Senate has until midnight on Sunday to pass something or not pass something, and they're not even going to be back in session until the, like, 5 o'clock. So they're going to have a few hours to debate these bills. They already debated last week and couldn't come to a decision on. I mean, Congress is obviously so dysfunctional that they can barely agree on naming post offices. So, you know,
thank God for gridlock.
At this point, it's finally coming back to help the American people in a sense that they can't agree to renew the Patriot Act. They also can't agree on these watered down reforms. So it's very possible on Monday the Patriot Act, at least Section 215, will have expired.
Man. All right. And now that's the only part of it that's up for sunset at this point?
Well, there's two other parts that are up for sunset, kind of minor clauses. There's something called the lone wolf provision, which has actually never been used, or at least the government claims it's never been used. And then there's something called the roving wiretap provision, which essentially allows them to get a warrant for a person that has multiple devices that they're communicating on. But then again, that also has been reinterpreted in secret, as Marcy Miller wrote about the other day. So, it's certainly, you know, the idea that the sky is falling and that the government is never going to be able to actually track terrorists is, obviously absurd. They have, you know, half a dozen other legal authorities to conduct surveillance.
Well, I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about them having the ability to continue violating all our rights. Are they going to still have that?
Exactly. It's just that they've been, you know, obviously in this last week, they've been, you know, trying to throw out all sorts of hypothetical scare scenarios to terrify people into thinking that they're actually losing something if this bill expires, and they're actually not.
Right. And, of course, the standard for tapping any suspected agent of a foreign power, including any agent of a foreign terrorist group, and I don't know, I must assume they've expanded this to, you know, so-called lone wolves, proven somehow to be in contact with any foreign terrorist group as well, that the standard for tapping them under the FISA Act of 1978 is, I forget if it's just reasonable suspicion or lower than that, but they're virtually never denied. And in fact, they even already had an emergency provision where they could tap you for 72 hours before bothering to get back to the judge about it. And that's how it already was before the Patriot Act was ever even passed. Am I wrong?
No, you're exactly right. You know, this idea that, like, the government was, had their hands tied behind their back before 9/11 was always just crazy. You know, there's tons of evidence showing the FBI knew of some of the hijackers and some of the agents had tried to warn others, and that there was bureaucratic infighting between the FBI and the CIA, and that's why they were, keeping data from each other. There was nothing... You know, there was nothing that they didn't already have that they needed to stop attacks like this. And, you know, these laws are just an excuse. We know that when they passed the Patriot Act, it was actually just laws that law enforcement had wanted to get passed for decades. But because they just weren't politically tenable, they couldn't. And so basically they got everything in their dreams after 9/11 and have used, by and large, many provisions of the Patriot Act, you know, 99% of the time against, you know, cases involving drugs and that have nothing to do with terrorism. Mm-hmm.
And now, did I read right that the, I think it was Judge Napolitano's column, he said that the Inspector General had just came out and said, of the Justice Department, I guess, maybe the NSA itself, and said that, no, actually, they didn't get anything useful from this program the whole time.
Yeah, this is the most amazing part of this whole past week, is that the Justice Department released this incredibly timely, comprehensive report that concluded on the very first page that Section 215 of the Patriot Act had not produced any major case developments in its existence, and that it actually isn't this tremendously vital tool that the administration has been saying for years. And yet the media has basically ignored this report, again, from the Justice Department. This is an outside report. This is from the Justice Department's Inspector General, mm-hmm. who interviewed countless FBI agents and Justice Department officials about the law. And even though they concluded that it's not vital at all, that we don't really need it, that it basically just repeats information we already have, that, you know, that the sky will fall and, you know, hell will rain down upon us, mm-hmm. You know, next week when this law expires. And it's just ridiculous.
All right. Now, so two more questions in very little time. The first one is, are they still going to be able to use Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act and Executive Order 12333 to violate our rights to basically in the same way, in other words, to go around the cancellation of this part of the Patriot Act? And then secondly, is there a campaign somewhere that you can refer people to where people are working, making phone calls, writing letters, sending faxes, doing whatever they can to select members of Congress to make sure to keep Patriot from being reauthorized and to keep USA Freedom from being passed?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the number one thing you got to do right now is call your senator, because they are actually having this vote, and there are so many votes up for grabs. It's not like one of these normal congressional votes where things are kind of decided in advance. They are panicking, and any support that they have from the public will do a lot of good. As far as if they can do this again if the law expires, you know, they claim that they're not, that they have to shut down the program. Whether we believe them or not is one thing, but we have to remember the only reason that this was authorized by the FISA court to begin with was because they thought that Congress had somehow secretly authorized it. And so once Congress takes away its authority, hopefully the FISA court will too, and we already know it's been declared illegal in public court. And so there's no way that they can do this without breaking a whole host of other laws that would be very hard to avoid getting prosecuted under.
Right. All right. Well, thanks again for coming back on the show and for your education on this very important subject. I think this is one of those where you got some swing votes, and the way it shakes out with party breakdowns and stuff, this really could, we could see a successful Sunday here if people get in gear. Not that I believe in politics too much, but this might work. Thanks very much again, Trevor.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That's the great Trevor Tim, everybody. He's at TheGuardian.com. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Asa Winstanley, an investigative journalist who writes for the Electronic Intifada. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good. Glad to be here.
Good, good. Happy to have you. So you've been writing about this subject for a very long time. It's a very important one. I believe the latest is, why is the media ignoring Israel's alliance with Al-Qaeda? And I guess we'll get back to the media part, but Israel's alliance with Al-Qaeda, whatever do you mean? Just the facts, as many of them as you can marshal, please.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. It's a pretty shocking claim on the surface, because Al-Qaeda as a movement, as leaders, have had a history of anti-Israel rhetoric. Historically, Al-Qaeda has not really ever attacked its Israeli targets. It's focused on one hand, American civilian targets and American military targets, and of course, you know, attacks in European countries as well against civilians. And on the other hand, on sectarian attacks against Muslims in Arab countries. But it hasn't really attacked Israel. But what I'm referring to specifically is a tactical alliance between Israel at the moment in Syria and Al-Qaeda's Syrian branch, the Nusra Front.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you got on them?
Well, what's happening is that there's been, over the last few years, there's been an ongoing debate in Israeli elite circles of which side in the Syrian civil war they really want to win. There's been some discussion of, well, maybe the Bashar al-Assad regime wouldn't be so bad if, as long as they can keep the border quiet. But what seems, in my judgment, what's come out now on top is the strategy of, in the words of a former Israeli diplomat to in the US, he turned the strategy, paraphrasing what he said, but he said, we want to let both sides bleed, hemorrhage to death. So it's a strategy of prolonging the civil war, because they want to do that, because the longer Arabs are fighting each other, they won't be fighting Israel. So what they're doing at the moment is providing logistical and possibly military support to the Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda's official Syrian franchise, in the Golan Heights, in the occupied Golan Heights, which is in southwestern Syria.
Okay, now, how can you be so sure?
Okay, well, what we know is that it was widely reported last year in August that the Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda in Syria, took over Quneitra, which is a key crossing point in the Golan Heights. Now, the Golan Heights is part of Syria. It was occupied. Part of it is occupied by Israel and has been occupied since 1967. But it's really part of Syria. So that's classified as an illegally occupied territory. But in practice, on the ground, Israel has occupied it since 1967. There's a separate sector of the Golan Heights which the Syrian government managed to retain control of. Now, of course, with the civil war ongoing, in August last year, the Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda in Syria, managed to take over a key checkpoint in the town of Quneitra in the Golan Heights. And that directly borders onto Israeli controlled. So the border, it's not really a border crossing. It's actually a ceasefire line, technically. But the Israelis refer to it as a border crossing, but it's not a border. It's just actually from one part of Syria to another. But in practice, there's a key checkpoint between the Syrian side and the Israeli side, in which the Israelis are in direct contact with Syrian rebels. Now, since August of last year, those rebels are overwhelmingly Al-Qaeda. And the UN reports that there's a UN peacekeeping force in the region, and there has been for many decades. It's called UNDOF. And their reports have observed and confirmed contacts between the rebel forces and the Al-Qaeda forces and between Israeli military. Now, the UN doesn't explicitly say they were Al-Qaeda because, you know, they're not. I suppose they're not going to be going up to them and say, hey, you know, do you have an Al-Qaeda membership card or anything like that. But that's been confirmed that they and since we know. So it was confirmed they were rebels, but and since we know that the vast majority of those rebels have been Al-Qaeda in that area since August last year, the UN reports have confirmed that those contacts have been ongoing. Mm-hmm. So that's the initial starting point of this. Okay, but that's you know that's not quite enough. But there's been several confirmations of this, and within mainstream media, but it's underreported. So like. I've listed, you know, several of these things in my articles. One of them came in March when an Israeli military official told the Wall Street Journal that they confirmed these reports. So what I mean by an alliance is providing logistical support. So what that's taking, what we know for sure that is happening is that the Israelis are treating Syrian rebel fighters in their hospitals. They set up a field hospital what they consider the border, on the ceasefire line. They're treating those fighters in the hospital. That doesn't necessarily prove anything, right? Because, you know, they have this propaganda line about how they're just playing a humanitarian role and so on and so forth. Okay, but the key difference is they're treating these rebel fighters who are overwhelmingly Al-Qaeda, and they once they finish treating them in the field hospital, they allow them to go back to Syria to fight again against the government. Now, if they were Palestinian resistance fighters from Hamas, for example, or they were Lebanese resistance fighters from Hezbollah who had been treated in Israeli hospitals, there is no way in hell they would send them back to Gaza or to Lebanon or to Syria to fight again, because those forces are adamantly opposed to Israeli occupation forces. Now, why are Al-Qaeda fighters not adamantly opposed to Israeli occupation forces, despite, you know, years of anti-Israel rhetoric from Osama bin Laden? We, you know, there's a lot of unanswered questions here, and it does actually make me angry, because it's an absolute scandal how the mainstream media is just ignoring this.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been joking for more than a year now about how really, if it wasn't for Israel's fifth column in the United States right now, splitting the policy in such absurd directions, we would have a full-scale war against the Islamic State right now. But since that would be, in effect, fighting for Iran and Assad and over Israel's dead body. So instead, the policy just kind of flounders around. And in fact, it's to the good, really, because it could be a lot worse right now, couldn't it? You know what I mean? If the lines were clear and our government, or the U.S. government, was just picking one side or the other to intervene on, they would be intervening much more severely, I think.
My line to you is not 100% clear, so I missed a little
it's
of some
all
of
right.
that.
It wasn't very important or insightful or anything.
I get your overall point, which is that
talking about the irony of the fact that because the policy is so anti-Iranian, because that's what Israel wants, then that means that the war against the Islamic State has been prevented from being much worse than it has been so far. And now I'm sorry, we got to take this break, but we'll be back in just a few minutes. We're talking with Asa Winstanley, wrote a bunch of very important pieces here at MiddleEastMonitor.com, and they're about Israel and the al-Nusra Front. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, kids, welcome back. I'm him, Scott Horton. It's my show. Hey, by the way, I keep forgetting to say this on one or the other of these interviews so that the podcast archive listening people can hear it. Support me on Patreon. You can do that. Go to scotthorton.org and look for the link in the right-hand margin there. And you can just donate a quarter per interview if you want. That sounds fair, don't it? Or a dollar? I don't know. Whatever. Anyway, here is Michael Oren. I'm sorry to play an entire minute-long clip, but I think it's worthwhile here. I'm talking with Asa Winstanley from the Electronic Intifada here.
If we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, you know, if someone's got to, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail.
All right. So, yeah, even worse there than let it be a no-win grind forever. Go ahead and let al-Qaeda win. Let the Islamic State win. I mean, he makes it clear who he's talking about. He's not referring to the mythical moderates here. He's talking about the ISIS who had just massacred a bunch of Shiite airmen in Iraq. Was, you know, the massacre he was referring to there. And then, of course, his excuse, Asa, is the pretended military capability of Iran's nuclear program, which only exists in comic books and in, I guess, the highest councils of Israeli national security affairs. That's the excuse for it. And so that's Michael Oren, the last ambassador to the United States under Benjamin Netanyahu. And he's explaining it in a very hoity-toity, comfortable kind of conference setting. He's talking to Jeffrey Goldberg, and it's a very kind of in-group sort of thing. It's just that YouTube was there, too. And so that admission just came right out. But now, so I understand that. I'm not saying I agree with it. I think it's insane, actually. But I understand Likud says, hey, Iran and therefore Syria and Hezbollah, they are our concern, and we don't care who knocked down the towers or any of that. We have our own priorities and that kind of thing. But going so far as to actually help the al-Nusra Front, and seemingly only in a marginal kind of a way that's not really going to make or break the difference for them or anything, but it's just enough to make the Israelis guilty of supporting America's worst enemies. Not that the Americans haven't been supporting them too, but still, yeah. It seems like a risky PR move for the Israelis, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're exactly right. They're not out to secure an outright victory for al-Qaeda by any means. It's just enough to sort of keep things ticking over, you know? You know, we have to understand this Israeli support within the context of wider Western support for these so-called rebels. Because, you know, all these regional forces that are allied with American and European imperial powers, like the Saudis most of all, are now supporting al-Qaeda. And that was a really interesting clip from Michael Oren. I'd not heard that. But, yeah, I mean, it confirms the same sort of thinking again. And, yeah, I mean, the thing you say about PR is interesting because they're kind of they feel confident enough that they're allowed to do it, to let it slip, you know. So, like I mentioned, in March, an Israeli military official talked to the Wall Street Journal, and he said about these rebels, so-called rebels, who are coming and being treated in this Israeli field hospital. He said, "We don't ask who they are. We don't do any screening. Once the treatment is done, we take them back to the border, and they go on their way in Syria." So they feel confident enough to let that go through, but they've also taken certain moves to cover it up to a certain extent. Like when it was getting a certain amount of attention, there was a Syrian activist, a pro-government, pro-Syrian government activist in the Golan Heights, in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. And his name is Sed Gilmaket, who was arrested earlier this year and put in detention in a case that the Israeli press was initially banned from reporting. And he had, I mean, he's like a known activist, but he'd just sort of gone out with his, you know, with his mobile phone camera, and he started, you know, because, you know, the Syrian Arabs who still live in the Golan Heights, they see all this going on. You know, they're mostly from the Druze religious minority. Mm-hmm. And they go out and they see all these Israeli soldiers, and they know exactly what's going on, because it's obvious. You know, it's they can see there must be some sort of coordination between these Nusra Front Al Qaeda rebels and the Israeli army. They can see it happening. And so he went out and he started, you know, filming and trying to document some of this. And he reportedly got a tip off from an Israeli soldier about it, because you know, he was arrested and he's in jail now just for putting the, it was called the Facebook spy case in the Israeli media, because he was ludicrously charged with spying for an so-called enemy state, Syria. By posting stuff on his Facebook page about what was going on.
Amazing. So, yeah, I mean, they got no coverage. Your article is the first that I had heard of that one.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, the only place I've seen it is it's been on the Syrian state Sana website. And it's been on and they've got an English website. And it's been on Syrian state TV in Arabic. And Richard Silverstein, the American blogger, he wrote about it. He was the first place I saw it, and that's how I first learned about it. And then the Israeli press, because after it came out on the internet, the Israeli media, the Israeli military dropped the ban, because they have this military censorship system in the press, so that, you know, they didn't stop it coming out because it went on the internet. So then they kind of partially lifted the gag order. Yeah, I mean, these are all things that are woefully undercovered. And I mean, as I tried to make the point in my last article, if the shoe was on the other foot, so to speak, and it was the Iranians supporting Al Qaeda in this way, or even having you know, contacts with Al Qaeda, it would be a major scandal. I mean, you know, we saw that more than a decade ago, where they tried to say that Saddam Hussein was in alliance with Al Qaeda, which was ridiculous. At the time, because Al Qaeda and Saddam Hussein were, you know, bitter enemies, and Al Qaeda at that time had no presence in the country, but part of their propaganda was to make up this rubbish about a supposed Al Qaeda group that Saddam Hussein was in alliance with. Of course, we all know that was lies now, but of course, ironically, the American and British occupation of Iraq led to a massive resurgence of Al Qaeda, you know, and ultimately the birth of the so-called Islamic State.
Yep. Now, and that's the whole thing is, you know, George Bush inadvertently, I think everyone would agree, inadvertently scored this huge own goal for Al Qaeda by giving them all of Western and Northwestern Iraq to be jihadistan, kind of lawless suicide bomber land at war for a decade straight. But then Obama went and doubled down, and as we're seeing in this DIA document, the set of DIA documents, he fought directly for the Libyan and Syrian veterans of Al Qaeda in Iraq, the guys who were the enemies from the last war, who, again, like you said, were created from the war. But then Obama followed them home and then took their side in Libya and Syria, and you have all the two new Judicial Watch documents. But I went back and double checked the Seymour Hersh piece about the sarin, where he debunked the sarin gas attack. But in there, he has a whole section about the rat line. It's even called the rat line and the red line.
Yeah.
And the rat line is the CIA running all these guns and jihadis after their great victory against Gaddafi in Libya onto Syria to continue the fight. So
absolutely,
it ain't just Israel. It's, you know, the U.S. has been leading the way this whole time. And I guess, you know, it does seem as though Obama's been somewhat reluctant, but boy, he sure hasn't been stopping the Israelis, the Turks, the Saudis, the Qataris from doing it, or even really trying. It doesn't look like. Am I wrong about that, do you think?
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. And I think there's a lot more that will come out about this. And I think you make a very good point about Seymour Hersh's Syria articles. You know, Seymour Hersh is a man I have a lot of respect for as a journalist. I think he's an excellent journalist. He got, of course, his whole career, he's got flak and official denials. But I've never seen him. And I followed his articles all through the Iraq War period and the so-called War on Terror period. And I never saw the response, the bitter response that he got for anything compared to his pieces about Syria. And as you said, a lot people were very skeptical of those pieces about the Syria chemical weapons from Seymour Hersh. And, you know, fair enough. But I think a lot in those articles has been borne out by the facts, and people should bear that in mind.
Right. In fact, the New York Times even had to back off and do a sort of semi-official retraction of their claims on the issue, as Robert Perry, you know, nailed them to the wall for it.
Yeah.
You know, in backing up that story. Mm. And yeah, in fact, I mean, really, relatively speaking, they kind of just brushed Hersh's Syria article under the rug compared to the way they went after him for the bin Laden story, because that was an attack on the official state religion and the, you know, the getting the bad guy and all that. So they couldn't let that stand. They had to really attack the hell out of him for that. But on the Syria story, they basically just pretended he didn't exist, right? The guy that broke the My Lai story and, you know, 10,000 cents.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I found that really interesting earlier this month when his whole Bin Laden article came out. I mean, I thought it was a great article. You know, I found it very convincing. You know, interpretations could vary. You know, he might not be right about every single detail, but I think he makes an extremely convincing case. And I think that the issues at stake in his Bin Laden piece are possibly less than the ones about Syria and the implications about Syria. But it's like you said, it's a state religion. You know, you can't. All he was really saying in that piece was, well, the administration lied about the particular way that it killed bin Laden.
Right.
It's not a particularly radical thing to say. Like, who really denies that now, except for the White House? But the reaction to it was insane. Like, it was, oh, what a conspiracy theory. You're saying the administration lied? How could you? You know, it is like a state religion, you know. It's just, when he challenged these things, he got called, you know, a crank and a conspiracy theorist and all these kind of things. And now he slowly, as with Seymour Hersh's record, he's being borne out. You know, there's being a slow trickle of confirmations from independent sources. Mm-hmm. And I think more will come out over the following months and years.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, you go back to that Syria article, and it was about Turkey. You know, there's been sort of this mythology going on here. We were talking about this with Gareth Porter the other day on the show. I hope it's okay. I'm keeping you a couple minutes over time into the break here. But, oh, no, in fact, I got to go and talk with Ray. Well, there's been this kind of narrative that this is all sort of an accident. Well, we've been trying to support the FSA and the moderates, and then, sort of kind of created this space for al-Nusra. Yeah. You couldn't even get them to admit that much. But you go back to Hersh's article about the rat line and the red line, and it's about Turkey working with Nusra to stage that attack summer of 2013.
Point.
And in fact, before that, they had a couple trial runs in the spring of 2013.
This is an extremely important point. You know, there's something in that. You know, it's not all a grand conspiracy where America and the Saudis and everyone knew what they were doing all along. You know, it's not all things went wrong for them. You know, they were responding to events. Absolutely. You know, things looked, especially in 2011, when it looked like all these pro-American, pro-Western government Arab regimes were going to be overthrown. You know, they were responding to events. Definitely. But at the same time, there is a very definite pattern of what they were trying to do. They were trying to support forces, and they're still trying to support forces in the region, which are, to say the least, morally questionable. And now we see, it's absolutely bizarre what you see now in the mainstream media this week. What we're seeing is an attempted mainstreaming of Al-Qaeda. They're saying, well, actually, you know, Islamic State is the real extremist. Al-Qaeda maybe is not so bad now. You know, this is the, you know, we're seeing this in interview with on Al Jazeera this week with the leader of the Nusra Front. I mean, things that are going on now are absolutely it just boggles the mind, really.
Well, I mean, and they announced beforehand, you know, that, yeah, we're going to do this rebranding. We're going to have him say that he doesn't like Zawahiri anymore, which they didn't do that, right? They just kind of didn't bring up Zawahiri, I guess.
He did. He said the opposite. He said the leader of Nusra Front, in his interview this week with Al Jazeera, he told, he said in the interview, I've been in contact with Zawahiri. And he's making it very clear that he's had recent orders from him. And it's interesting, actually, the orders apparently that Zawahiri gave him was that they're not going to use Syria as a base to attack the West. Now, of course, nobody in their right mind believes that. That's the strategic PR stunt on their behalf. They want to get as much territory as they can so they can have a base in Syria. Later on, no doubt, there will be blowback. But they're trying to make this appeal to the West to tacitly let the Saudis support them. The Saudis and the Turks and the Qataris support them and send them sophisticated weapons and allow them. And this is what's happening. Absolutely. There's been the rebels were starting to fall apart because they were not unified. Right.
Sorry, Asa, we got to go, man. I got to go. Thank you so much for your time and your great writing. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Okay, that's Asa Winstanley, everybody. He writes for the Electronic Intifada and for Middle East Monitor at MiddleEastMonitor.com. We'll be right back with Ray McGovern in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, the Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. They were so determined to take down Assad, they poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens of thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda.
Oh, come on. What does the vice president know about it? He said he was sorry for saying that, so obviously it was a big mistake on his part. Hey, guess what, everybody? We got the great Ray McGovern on the phone. He's great. He used to be a CIA guy, but now he's a legit human being and does great work for peace all the time and has for years and years and years. He's the co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and he's a great piece, Nick. He does a lot of speaking going around with Tell the Word. You can contact him through there to have him come speak to your church or your group or whatever it is. And he writes a hell of a lot of great stuff. You can find it all at raymcgovern.com, antiwar.com, and consortiumnews.com. Welcome back to the show, Ray. How are you, sir?
Thanks, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. Now, check this out. We're going to talk some history with you here. You have two recent pieces, both of which take on various aspects of what really happened in Iraq War II. Of course, there are a lot of self-justifying mythologies and narratives surrounding that war and how it happened and what went wrong and when and why and everything else. And especially, and we saw this all happening like a slow-motion train wreck at the time, that it started out, the slogan was, "The surge is working! The surge is working!" And it didn't matter that it wasn't working. It only mattered that the slogan was just a great slogan, I guess. I don't know. It didn't really work on me, but apparently it was really great for a lot of people. They just loved it, and they would say it over and over again. And then they just changed it to "the surge worked," which doesn't quite ring as well, you know, audibly, I don't think, as working. But anyway, people love "the surge worked," too. That had even more self-congratulation to it and cover-up in it. And so everybody loves believing that myth, as you call it in the title of your article, Resurgence of the Surge Myth. And it's important, right, that that we correct this. I was thinking, Ray, that, you know, if they have to claim victory in order to end any of these wars, I guess I don't mind. But then the problem is they go, yeah, that's right. It was a victory, all right. And then they use that as the excuse to double down the next one, like they did with the Iraq surge myth in Afghanistan.
That's right. Right now they're asking for a mulligan in golf terms. But a mulligan comes after you screwed up your tee shot, right? If they don't admit that they screwed up their tee shot, they'll just drive straight down the fairway and we'll be in another even greater mess.
Yep. Well, and so it's kind of complicated, but go ahead and fill us in. What all was the surge? What was it supposed to accomplish? What did it accomplish?
Yeah. Well, if people can be excused for not knowing many of these facts because they couldn't find them in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, LA Times, any of the so-called major media.
Plus, it was eight years ago now.
Yeah, well, actually almost nine. We're talking the summer of 2006, and things were going very, very poorly indeed in Iraq. And our general on the scene, General Casey, and General Abizaid, who had purview over that area, he was based in Tampa, but he spent most of his time in that area, they came to the conclusion that, my God, you know, there is sectarian hatred like we've never experienced before. You know, they shouldn't have been surprised at that. But this is never going to work. If the Shia can always figure they can depend on us and they don't have to give any power sharing to the Sunni. Instead, they put them all in jails and torture them. That, you know, this is not really doing much for reconciliation. They'll never get their act together as long as we stay in country. And worst of all, my God, the politicians are talking about adding troops. So what happened? Well, all through the fall of 2006, they leaked to the press that more troops were not a good idea, okay? And then when John McCain and his stalwarts from the Senate Armed Services Committee called them to testify, and I have a quote here, it always helps to have facts, right? Facts and quotes and documents. So here's John McCain asking General Abizaid, again, CENTCOM commander, he said, well, you know, why not? We would like to have 20,000 more troops in here, says McCain. And this is what Abizaid says. Senator McCain, I met with every divisional commander, General Casey, the Corps commander, General Dempsey, and I asked them, in your professional opinion, if we were to bring in more American troops now, does that add considerably to our ability to achieve success in Iraq? And they all said no. And the reason is because we want the Iraqis to do more. It is easy for the Iraqis to rely on us to do this work. I believe that more American forces prevent the Iraqis from doing more, from taking more responsibility for their own future. The date, November 15, 2006, just at the time when real decisions had to be made as to whether to attenuate our presence there or to have a surge. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, our ambassador in Iraq, Khalid Zad, he sent a classified cable into Washington saying pretty much the same thing. He said, look, a surge is not going to be sustainable. Let's see, another quote here. He said that he was trying to negotiate a political solution with the Israelis, with the Iraqis, and, quote, proposals to send in more U.S. forces would not produce a long-term solution and would not make our policy sustainable. So there's Khalid Zad, the ambassador. There's the top military brass. What do we have next? Well, now we have the establishment-heavy Iraq Study Group. Now, this was a group that was formed largely at the initiative of Congress. Bush and Cheney didn't much care for it, but there's some really good people on it, some really good experts, and it was led by James Baker. And no, you know, no slouch he, and no wimp he, or leftist he, and of course the Democrat that they always trot out for such occasions, Lee Hamilton. Well, they came to the conclusions of their study And as I say, it was populated by leading lights, including a fellow named Robert Gates, who had been head of the CIA and other things. Okay, so they all get together and they decide exactly the same thing. They say a change in the primary mission of U.S. forces that would enable the U.S. to begin to move its combat forces out is absolutely necessary. The situation in Iraq is grave and deteriorating. So they have those three. You have the generals, you have Habibat, now you have the Iraq Study Group.
One Donald Rumsfeld, too, right?
Yeah, that's getting to it. Yeah, you know, the thing that people don't realize is that Rumsfeld himself was committing the mortal sin of going wobbly on a war that was based mostly on his own misguided advice. It was very much similar to what happened in Vietnam when Robert McNamara, also previous defense secretary, went wobbly on Vietnam and said, you know, I'm out of here. This is not going anywhere.
Well, the thing is, too, he was making sense, right? He was saying the same thing that you're saying, basically, in economic terms, that we've created a moral hazard for these groups. And he would always say it in the most demeaning way. We need to take the training wheels off and this kind of thing. But if they were being honest at all, what they were sort of getting to was the Shia have right now some reason to compromise with the Sunni they've displaced. But if we send in more troops to be their auxiliaries to help them ethnically cleanse or sectarianly cleanse the towns and especially the capital city even more, then we're giving them less reason to compromise rather than more. And so it was actually really pretty simple. And Donald Rumsfeld is probably right for the first time in his life about something when he said that's an S-candy. Yeah. And now we got to take this break because we both went on so long. But hang on one second. Sure. We'll be right back, everybody, with the great Ray McGovern in just a sec.
No problem.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C., but those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back. I'm talking with the great Ray McGovern. We're talking about the surge of 2006 and 7. The Republicans lost both houses of Congress. Bush was humiliated. The war was a disaster. The Iraq Study Group said it was time to end the war as the president's father's friends and all that. Donald Rumsfeld said, hey, let's get the hell out of here, man. Not that I'm sorry. And then Bush went with Fat Neck Fred Kagan and General Jack Keane, and they decided to surge. Not only are we not leaving, we're doubling down, and it's going to accomplish A, B, C, X, Y, and Z. Tell them, Ray.
Well, that was the problem for Bush and Cheney when they realized that every sensible person in Washington and in the field was saying it's a fool's errand to send more troops in. Bush and Cheney went to the American Enterprise Institute, as they usually do, and they said, well, what does it mean for us? And the answer came back loud and clear from the Kagans, Frederick especially, and from this Jack Keane, who used to be Vice Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army. They said, well, it means, Mr. President, you lose a war on your watch. And he said, well, gosh, you know, how can we avoid that? And I said, well, we've just got the thing for you, Mr. President. And we call it a surge. Actually, it's a good word, surge. You know, kind of, you know, manly. Almost, oh, yeah, surge. So this is what we're going to do. We put in 30,000 folks. We separate the Shia from the Sunni in Baghdad. We ethnically cleanse that city. Of course, we let the Shia do most of the work. And all we need is a general to do this, and we have the guy right here. His name is David Petraeus. He's right in the next room. He's got 12 rows of ribbons and merit badges and stuff. He's a good-looking guy. He's the guy that can do this. Oh, Charlie, what we need is a defense secretary, because clearly Rumsfeld has outlived his usefulness. He's gone wobbly. So you got any ideas? So Bush calls up his daddy and says, Dad, got any ideas? And of course, Bobby Gates will do it. And Bush said, well, Bobby Gates has done that here.
Ray, your audio has gotten real bad on us. Can you switch back to where you were?
I'm doing what I can here. We'll probably be between towers up at the Jersey Turnpike. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we'll make do. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Elder Bush says, Little Bush, look, George, just call Bobby Gates. Little Bush says, yeah, but he was on the Iran study group. Big Bush, Bobby Gates is a real, how shall I say it, not a chameleon. He's a sort of a windsock guy. If you told me he could be Secretary of Defense, he'll do it. And sure enough, on the 5th of November, just before the election, Bush meets with Gates in Crawford, and he explains, you know, we're going to double down here. We're going to have a surge. We got a really beautiful general to do the hard work. All you have to do is go out to Baghdad and cashier, well, not cashier, you give General Casey a cynic. I'm about to be chief of staff. The cashier, do that, Patricia.
Oh, man. All right, well, everybody, we're talking with Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst, and we're having a little bit of cell phone problems, but I'm going to see if maybe I can stall for time here for just a second and see if we can get a strong signal.
Yeah,
you sound
now
good now.
Go
ahead. Go ahead, Ray.
Okay, so that's what happened. Gates went out to Baghdad, came back. Bush, at the end of December 2006, he says, I'm inclined to add troops to Iraq, but I don't really – we need to give them a mission. This is what he said, quote, there's got to be a specific mission that can be accomplished with the addition of more troops, end quote, December 20th, 2006. Well, he couldn't just say, look, we want to make sure we don't lose the war on our watch, and we figure if we can – if we can separate Shia from Sunni in Baghdad and do other things with 30,000 more troops, well, you know, the cost is likely to be, as it was, 1,000 U.S. troops more killed in that surge, and, you know, countless dozens of thousands of Iraqis. But, hey, they did. It worked for their purposes. They waltzed out, or they actually rode out into the Western sunset after the administration was over without having lost the war, leaving bedlam behind, leaving inevitable bedlam. And look at Iraq today. I mean, my God, it's bedlam. And it's getting worse and worse still. Fred Kagan of the American Enterprise Institute and Jack Keane and Lindsey Nelson and Senator McCain, guess what they're pushing for? Another surge. That's what we need. Another surge, because the first one worked so beautifully. Oh, God. And you know what? It's really hard to tell this story to the general audience because it is a little complicated and because they've been conditioned to thinking that the surge worked. The worst thing, Scott, the worst thing of all was that when Obama was running for president, the sentiment was so thick that anyone who disparaged the surge was just a poor loser, right? A kind of a spoiled sport.
Right.
You know what he said? He said, gosh, I have to admit, the surge worked beyond all my expectations. My God, you know?
Right.
So that shows the kind of crowd that he's fallen in with and how naive he was then. And I just hope he's learned a couple lessons in the last 9 years.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing of it was, too, and we talked about this. People can go find you and I discussing this as was happening in 2006 and 2007 with all this. And as always, it couldn't possibly be right because It's never, I mean, their narrative, it's never based on any kind of reality at all. I mean, all we were hearing was it was the Iraqi people versus the terrorists, led by Zarqawi the terrorist, and we're against them on the side of the civilians or whatever. They never were honest at all to say, well, it's us and the winners of the election who are the United Iraqi Alliance, and they are made up of the following factions and their militias, and they're backed by Iran. And on the other side are, you know, the tribal chiefs and the Sunni imams and the you know, Baathist officers and the foreign fighters and the what, right? They never were honest about who was who and who was fighting for what or any of that. It was the whole thing. They didn't just lie us into it. They lied us into staying the whole time by just saying, well, listen, things will get worse if we leave. But they wouldn't say why. They, you know, there's never any kind of clarity to that. So the fact that they never had to explain meant they could never make a policy based on the reality of who's who and what it is they're doing. So they built up a Sunni army that could never be integrated into the Iraqi army. They said that was the plan, but in fact, they just really created the Islamic State is all they did.
Yeah, we were paying off the Sunni, you know, to fight al-Qaeda and not to make problems for the Maliki government. The understanding was that when we stopped paying off the Sunni, Maliki would pick up the tab. He didn't. Instead of that, he sent his Shia death squads into Sunni neighborhoods, cleaning them out, putting them in jail for torture. You know, most people don't remember that Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, he was in Iraq at precisely this time during the surge, July 2007 was when that WikiLeaks photograph of the brutalization of Iraqi civilians and of our own troops. Listen to them in a helicopter. It's awful, okay? So Bradley Manning saw that, and he saw on the ground how young students were being wrapped up, put into jail, where there was torture going on, all because they wrote a term paper to criticize the Maliki government. So these kinds of things come back to bite you. And when people with some sense of honesty and integrity see the awful things that are going on, they try to change them. Now, Bradley Manning is that. So is Ed Snowden. Right. Now,
thanks for bringing that up, because that's a not very often told part of that story. That, you know, oh, yeah, the kid was gay and was having an identity crisis or transgender, this, that, whatever, when what happened was he told his superior officer, my God, man, I had this document translated and it's a newspaper op-ed about basic corruption. And yet my job is to turn this guy over to be tortured and maybe to death. And his superior officer told him, that's right, get back to work.
Yeah.
And that was the line that was crossed. You know, that gets dropped from the narrative of what happened there. And even I oftentimes talk about Chelsea Manning as heroic just in terms of the quantity and quality of intelligence leaked. But, you know, I forget myself of what, you know, at the time in the actual situation, what a heroic thing that was as a response to
what she was
being made
age.
To participate in.
Yeah, he was the same age as these young college students, you know, and to see them, he knew what went on in those jails. It was one of these, what I call immediate personal experiences of unnecessary or, you know, unjustified suffering. And he saw it firsthand, and then he saw the WikiLeaks stuff, and he said, this is it. I owe it to my people in America to expose what's going on. Now, even, you know, I have to sort of say, Rumsfeld had it right at the very end. So did the Iraq Study Group, Jim Baker, and so did Khalidzad. Did they say anything? So did Casey, the generals, Casey and Abizaid. There's this sort of a merger code where no matter how important it is for the Americans to know what's really going on, nobody says anything. Even the good guys. Now, I always think of the General Zinni, big hotshot Marine general, head of CENTCOM in his day. He retired, you know, and he's sitting on the 26th of August, 2002, at the Veterans for Foreign Wars convention because he's getting a medal. Okay, and who's the speaker? It's Dick Cheney. And Dick Cheney says Iraq is about to get a nuclear weapon. They have all manner of chemical, biological warfare. UN inspections aren't worried about them, blah, 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 blah. And Zinni is sitting there, and later,
3 years later, he admits to the press, you know, I was still getting the most highly classified information because I was back on contract, and nothing that Cheney said squared with what I knew to be the real intelligence. Now, that's really nice for him to tell us 3 years later, right? Why didn't he have the guts to break with the immersion, to break with the liars and get out there and say, you know, or go to Cheney first, see what the hell's going on here? He didn't. Neither did George Tenet. In his book, he says, you know, I didn't think it was my place to ask the vice president where he got that intelligence. Ugh. So, yeah. You know, there's a lot of blame to go around. But the worst, of course, is that Bush was duly apprised by his ambassador, by his military, by the Rock Study Group, not by Gates, because as soon as he was offered to be Secretary of Defense, he thought it was an outstanding idea to do a search.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get the worst kind of corruption, the worst kind of sycophancy, and that's what killed another 1,000 U.S. troops, and that figure is very valid. And, you know, I should add probably that the same thing happened with respect to Afghanistan. Gates and Petraeus were both the prime movers there, too. How many unnecessary U.S. troops died? 1,000 again. So they doubled down twice. Now, are they going to do it again? That's what we have to make sure they don't do. And,
yeah.
And unless you know this history, it's kind of hard to argue the case.
Well, you know, I got to bring up here, too, that they fought this entire little mini war against Sadr and his allies, the Shiite militia, in East Baghdad and in Najaf in 2007, as well as part of that surge. And there's a whole book about it called The Good Soldiers, the hell these guys went through and brought to the people of East Baghdad in the name of fighting Sadr. But who was Sadr? He was a member in good standing, one of the leaders of the Republican Party over there, man. He was part of the United Iraqi Alliance with the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council. And America had fought that entire war for him. And Maliki was only there with his support. He was one-third of that Shiite party that won the election of 05 and inherited the government. And so they were trying to marginalize him, and they never did. He was the least Iranian-backed of all of the Shiite leaders, and what did they do? They chased him into Iran, where he got more Iranian-backed and picked a fight with his militias and got who knows how many tens of thousands of people killed there in that giant war for nothing, in that giant war against the guy they were fighting for all along, and against the guy who right now is the leader of one of the primary militias, and his power has not been diminished whatsoever in all this.
Yeah, it's replete with ironies and idiocy. You know, the latest figure, accurate figure from a responsible organization of how many Iraqis were killed is a million, okay? 1 million. U.S. troops, well, 4,500. Now, I'd hate to have that on my conscience. And yet, this was all very deliberate. It was all politically inspired, as was the surge in Afghanistan. That one due to Obama's political needs, okay? I'm being bipartisan here. But, you know, when you think about what our country has become in condoning and pushing and actually conducting ethnic cleansing, and I'm talking about Baghdad, a city of about 6 million in those days, all right? It was a predominantly Sunni city. It became a predominantly Shia city, because we did a cordon sanitaire around it and let the Shia militia do their work. That's why the violence went down. Shia and Sunni were separated one from the other, and by and large, the Sunni were driven out. And how many refugees resulted from all this? Well, from the whole war, it's talking 4,500,000, 2 million internal refugees in Iraq still, and 2.5 million external refugees eking out an existence in places like Syria and Jordan. I mean, my goodness, if the American people need further proof of this, all they need to do is read what UCLA has done. They had a program with a commercial satellite, and they watched, mind you, Scott, they watched the lights go out in the Sunni neighborhoods of Baghdad over a period of the surge. I mean, my God, you know, just so that Cheney and Bush could waltz into the sunset not having lost the war? Well, I suppose we've seen worse in this country, but I've not seen worse.
Well, and at the time, it was 3,000 or 4,000 people killed a month during that, like the spring of 2007, especially around then. Sunni bodies stacked up in the morning on the side of the road like cordwood with drill holes in their skulls. Imagine dying like that. A power drill to the brain is how America's allied Badr Brigade and Wolf Brigade got their business done and kicking the Sunnis out of Baghdad, with America really fighting as their auxiliaries, not the other way around.
And, you know, if you think about ISIS today, Scott, well, they were spawned by all this. They were spawned by what that idiot Bremer did in dissolving the Iraqi army. They feed on all kinds of legitimate grievances. And, you know, they're pretty powerful now that the Israelis and the Saudis are supporting them to the hilt. I've never seen such an unfathomable, uncontrolled, disparate policy as the one we have in that part of the world. We want to remove Assad, but we don't want to do other things, and we're working with Iran and Baghdad, but we're not gonna, it's total chaos. And the sooner that we get adults into the White House and the State Department, the better.
Adults? Man, they're the ones who've been running this thing the whole time. I say put the kids in there. They got more sense than this crap. You know, that's what they said about George Bush and Dick Cheney and Colin Powell. They're like, finally, enough of the panty raids. We're going to finally have some adult responsibility in charge around here. That was how they got elected, for crying out loud. And they said, you know what? We know that George Jr. is a screw-up frat boy, but at least he's got his father's men with him, and we know we can trust their judgment.
Slight correction there. They didn't get elected, did they?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, you got me on a technicality there, but still tens of millions of people turned out to vote for him. It was close enough. But, yeah, no, you're right. They did steal it. Yeah.
But, you know, in a weird kind of sense, when we Americans decided that we could condone the stealing of a presidential election, you know, I was, you know, like everybody else at the time, well, the Supreme Court, you know, sure, they shouldn't have done that, but they did. So let's see. Well, no, we should have just gone out in the streets and said, no, you don't do this. You count all the votes. And when all the votes were counted, of course, we know that Gore would have won that one.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I was just waiting for the other shoe to drop. There's nothing hopeful in wait and see to me. I remember even The Onion had a headline that was America. This was like in the spring of 2001, maybe June 2001. Americans kind of snap out of it and realize that George W. Bush is actually the president. And I was thinking, oh, man, they think that this is just going to be a nothing presidency. But I say we're going to be at war by the end of the year. And, yeah.
Well, you weren't,
I'm good,
you weren't far off.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's so obvious. He bombed Iraq. At the end of his, I was telling people, watch, he'll bomb Iraq within his first month in power, and instead it was within his first week. And only Obama beat him by bombing Pakistan within 3 days of being inaugurated. That even put George Jr. to shame. But
well, you wonder who's running this country, Scott. You know, Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex, but now it's become the military-industrial, congressional, security services, media corporate complex. And that's, I dare say, very close to the definition that Mussolini gave fascism. And the government, corporations, and everybody else are waltzing to the tune set by the government. That's really dangerous. And what we need to do is stake out some territory now, live up to what Tom Paine and the founders of this country gave us, and face these guys down, because in the long run, I do think the American people will rise to the occasion if, and this is a big if people like you and others keep spreading some truth around enough to make them shake their heads and say, no, no, this shall not stand.
Yep. Well, I don't know, man. I guess I don't know what the proportions are. It seems like the movement is growing. It seems like the internet is changing things. We don't have to take it one direction from Rather Jennings and Brokaw anymore. But then again, that might just mean even more celebrity gossip and less things that matter than before. So I don't really know, Ray, but I tend to think that it's not really going to end until the dollar breaks, where they just spend so much money and print so much money that nobody accepts their money anymore. At that point, the CIA and the soldiers are going to have to hitchhike home from Central Asia or wherever they're left stranded.
That'll be the first time, Scott, that I'll be glad that I don't have any money.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, it's going to be ugly, but that's pretty much the way the Soviet Union fell, was just, guess what? We cannot sustain this. We would if we could, but we can't. It's over. And those days, I don't know how soon they're coming, but they're coming. And I don't know what else could stop them but that. But then again, I don't know. We got a very interesting election season coming up. I think we all know how it's going to turn out. Thanks, Ray, for coming back on my show. I sure do like talking with you.
You're most welcome, Scott. Take care now.
That's the great Ray McGovern, everybody. Right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I know you're asking, Scott, what's the rhyme or reason? How do you choose whether to stop an interview for the break or whether to continue right through it? I don't know, man. I suck at this, I admit it. Man, I meant to say at the end of that interview, support me on Patreon. Somebody emailed me and said, hey, man, I just stumbled across a tweet about this. I hadn't heard about it on your show. I didn't see it on your site. It's there on the site, but I can see why you might not have seen it. Yeah, that's a new way that you can help support the show. Say, for example, if you like the interviews on the show and you want there to keep being interviews, well, sign up and you can pledge a quarter, or 50 cents, or 75 cents, or a dollar, or $10, or $1,000, or $150 million per interview. You can set it at whatever you want. You can cap it at per this much per month, maximum, etc. It's a kind of cool thing, man. So, yeah, patreon.com/Scott Horton Show to transfer wealth from you to me. And, yes, I'm going to continue giving it away free anyway, but I'm just saying, you know, wouldn't it be nice kind of thing. That's all. All right. And then the raffle thing, I am giving away a vacation to Costa Rica. So there's a reason to keep listening to this show to find out how. But what we're going to do, we're going to sell raffle tickets, and you're going to get a week's vacation. I mean, the winner is going to get a week's vacation with food and the room included, but you got to fly yourself there, but still. And that'd be cool, right? You think I can get rid of a few raffle tickets along those lines, guys? Who wants to go to Costa Rica? I want to go, but I can't. I got to raffle the thing off to you. Anyway, so that's coming up. That's a thing you need to know about if you like Costa Rica or you want to try liking it. And also, buy transcripts. You can buy transcripts of this show now. ScottHorton.org. No, no, no. Of the interviews. ScottHorton.org/transcripts. Just send me money and tell me which one you want, and then I will get you it. Does that sound like a good deal or what? Because a lot of times people say to me, I wish I had transcripts of this interview or that interview. Well, now you can, for the low, low cost of not very much at all. I think I set it at $2.50. That's pretty good for an interview transcript, don't you think? So there you go. ScottHorton.org/transcripts. We need to have an embedded link. Buy a transcript of this interview here at the bottom of each blog entry of the show. I wonder if there's a way to include that in the ID3 meta this and that kind of crap. I don't know, man. I need help. Professional help. Hey, Dennis Hastert is indicted. He's a corrupt criminal zillionaire. Well, you see, he was a high school gym coach, and now he's a zillionaire. And he became a zillionaire because of he cured cancer. I mean, because he invented a new widget. And there was high demand for it. I mean, because he was a politician and he sold influence and he used state power to make decisions like which way should the highway go and how much money will I get for my property when its value increases on the market due to the direction of the highway. And bribed by the Turks. You know, he's a longtime criminal, Dennis Hastert. Check out what he's guilty of. Not for being the Speaker of the House, which is crime enough. He's guilty of taking a bunch of money out of the bank in structured amounts less than the mandatory reported $10,000 in order to pay hush money to somebody. And according to the indictment, apparently the money, well, they don't say hush money, but that's the implication. And he'd been paying this since back before when he was a teacher, when he was a gym coach. So it's not some crime he committed as a congressman. Apparently, it's a crime he committed as a gym coach that he's been paying hush money for, lo, these many years. I can't imagine what that might be. Can you? They're not saying. But would you be surprised to find out if the Speaker of the House of Representatives was a rapist? Because I wouldn't. I'd be not surprised at all. In fact, didn't Hastert replace Gingrich when Gingrich failed to impeach and, well, no, I guess he did impeach, but failed to get removed, Bill Clinton the rapist? Isn't that kind of an interesting irony? Not Lewinsky, Juanita Broderick. Hey, that could be a great bumper sticker. Maybe I should make that. Juanita Broderick for Hillary Clinton's spokesperson. Or Juanita Broderick for Secretary of, I don't know, what do they call that? Internal Executive Branch, Human Relations or whatever? Human Resources. She'd be the Human Resources boss of Hillary's White House. Wouldn't that be fun? I think that could be fun. All right, anyway, is Hastert going to go to prison? Nah, probably not. But, I forgot to say, the other thing he got busted for? Lying to the FBI. They said to him, hey, man, what were you doing with this money? And he was saying, oh, me? You know, spending on myself. Blam. That's handcuffs. Huh? Trying to talk your way out of it to the FBI, saying something that's not true? Saying something that they could possibly spin as not true. They treat it like it's perjury. Like it's sworn perjury. And you realize here it doesn't have to be something that's not true. We're talking about Dennis Hastert here, so yeah, of course he's a criminal. But if they want to nail anyone, they can just nail you on lying to them, and they can just claim that whatever you said is a lie. Well, it's their word against yours anyway. Who says that you even said what they say you said? Yeah, Your Honor, he sat there and told us this and that. What? I didn't say that, you might say. Who's the judge going to believe? And that's why, if the FBI ever comes to you and wants to talk to you, you say to them, nothing. You don't even tell them you want to call your lawyer. Because what if you go inside and you call your spouse instead? And they say, blam, you lied to us. You said you wanted to call your lawyer. And you didn't. So, what does that mean? You're a liar, we're going to put you in prison. They can do whatever they want with you, so don't give them any ammo to do that. I think it's hilarious that the laws come down on Dennis Hastert in any way whatsoever, but I, at the end of the day, honestly, I agree with Robert Higgs. I really don't want the government even to prosecute Dick Cheney. I don't want them to prosecute anybody. I don't want them to do anything. I don't believe in the authority of these people to even prosecute each other. Just stop. Just stop. That Robert Higgs, he's got principle. I'd agree with them. By the way, hey, check it out, man. Omar Khadr did a thing last night. They ran a documentary about him on the CBC, was it? Canadian Broadcasting Company there? Yeah. And I couldn't find a stream of it or a video of it that worked. But then Mar Arar, who George Bush tortured, tweeted it out. And So there you go. Those who missed the Omar Khadr documentary that was on yesterday on CBC can watch here, he says. So just go to my Twitter feed. You don't have to have a Twitter account to look at my Twitter feed. Just go to twitter.com/Scott Horton Show, and you'll be able to find the link there to this documentary about Omar Khadr. And I don't know how good or bad it was, but if you're interested in that story, it's a very important one, if you ask me. Which you might or might not, you know. But yeah, man. Oh, also on my Twitter feed is a great speech that Ron Paul gave at Reason Magazine in 1983. And, man, it's just great. I love Ron Paul. He's so awesome. So watch that too. Twitter.com/Scott Horton Show. And you can see that great Ron Paul speech. All right. And then, I had killer cop stories today. Again, check my Twitter feed. Crazy one, man. There's video of the cops just unloading on this lady as she's already driven by them at like 5 miles an hour, maybe 4. And they're just unloading into her. And it was the one that went through the back of her headrest and through her neck that killed her. After she could not possibly, scientifically, could not possibly have been a threat to them. Cops murder some lady. She shouldn't have been stealing. She wouldn't have had any business with them in the first place, but still. And in fact, I presume her innocent. So, who says she was stealing? A bunch of murderer cops? Why should I believe them? They're willing to shoot her in the back to death. Anyway, more like that at my Twitter feed. That's where I'll be hanging out all weekend. No KPFK show this Sunday, but see y'all back here Monday. 11 to 1 Texas time. Thanks.